The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Well, it's Friday morning, November the 6th. I woke up this morning, and of course, the first thing I did was look at my phone to check to see what the election results were in the United States. You know, I mean, the election was on Tuesday, and we're still waiting to hear some of the key states. And as of this morning, Joe Biden pulls ahead in two of the key states, Pennsylvania and Georgia, albeit not with a lot of votes, but enough to sort of give him a bit of a lead and a pathway to the 270 electoral college votes that he needs to take the presidency. So that's where we're at, Jackie, this morning.
Yeah, some people are calling it election purgatory. Yeah. You know, it just keeps going on and on. But we're happy to have someone to talk to today that's going to tell us more about the potential scenarios and what it means for energy policy.
Exactly. And I'd like to introduce someone who's very well known within the energy world here in Canada and the United States, Robert Johnson, better known as RJ. He leads the Eurasia Group's Energy and Natural Resources Practice. RJ, both Jackie and I have known you for a long, long time. Welcome to our podcast.
It's great to be here with you guys. Greetings from the nation's capital here in Washington.
Great. Well, we're really happy to have you and hear your insights. You know, we booked this podcast today thinking that we would have plenty of time to understand the results of the U.S. election. Do we?
Partial understanding at best. I think that as we all look at our CNN screens this morning, Biden obviously is looking quite good for electoral college win. The question now is, does that translate into an inauguration? And then, of course, what's happening in the Congress as well. But it's definitely worth talking about the steps between the networks and the media calling the election for Biden and then actually getting vote certification through the electoral college in the Congress and to an actual inauguration, because we still have some significant uncertainty in that process, even though we think ultimately Biden will come out the other end.
Well, right. And potentially we'll have Donald Trump the whole time contesting any of the results. So maybe go into that then. Let's talk about the presidential role first. Who is the most likely president and how would that kind of play out in your view?
Yeah, so your age group, like many pollsters and experts, had a pretty strong view that Biden would win the Electoral College. And obviously now, looking at what happened Tuesday night, some of the states, the Democrats, significantly underperformed, like Ohio and Florida and a few states. But honestly, sitting here today on Friday, the polls are normalizing. And with one or two notable exceptions, Biden is going to come in about 5% ahead nationally. And in most of the states, going to be within the margin of error of the key forecast. So there's a little bit of validation there. But obviously, nobody predicted the twists and turns that it would take to get here with this new element of the pandemic and the heavy reliance on mail-in ballots, and the mail-in ballots skewing so much the Democrat side. But no, it looks like that Biden will emerge. I think it's, you know, our original 80% call, I think, is probably still where we are today. That probably went as low as 60% on Tuesday night, but still looks like Biden will get through. But the challenge is this, right, that Trump will look at recounts, he'll look at legal challenges of the vote certification number of states. He may try to mobilize some of the Republican-controlled state legislatures to overturn the state-level certifications, and then he may lean on other court interventions. He may lean on electors and electoral college, and he may lean on Congress, Republicans in Congress, to block the certification of electoral college tally, which happens on January 6th. So you really have a number of opportunities between now and January 6th for Trump to disrupt the transfer of power. But we would feel pretty comfortable. I think the markets agree with us as of now that Biden will come out the other side of that. But it's going to be pretty volatile literally for the next 2 months, potentially.
So without getting into the nuances of all these, this barrage of legal assaults that is predictable from the Trump side, is there a possibility that it could go beyond January 6th? I mean, with all the uncertainty?
Probably not. That's probably the firewall, I think, is January 6th, because at that point you would have to have the Republicans in the Senate rejecting the Electoral College certification of Biden. Now, of course, we have two runoff races in Georgia for the Senate that will determine whether or not the Republicans have 50 or 51 seats. Mm. And that election is literally the day before the January 6th certification. So it'll be a bit of chaos if it gets that far. Obviously, Biden will hope that he wins all these remaining states, gets over 300 votes in Electoral College, and then has a bit of momentum combined with the 5% win in the national tally to get enough moderate Republicans to pressure Trump essentially to concede. We think that's very unlikely in November. There's some chance it would happen in December, but you have to watch, you know, the Chris Christies and Larry Hogans and Mitt Romneys and other Republicans on the moderate side, Rob Portman from Ohio, people who've been sort of criticizing Trump and saying, you know, if you lose, you need to concede. So that'll be a key indicator of whether there's enough Republican pressure for Trump to concede, or at least maybe towards the December time frame. But I think we definitely have at least, you know, 3 or 4 weeks of fighting here before we get to that kind of scenario. And even then, it's not a guarantee.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about, you know, the president only has so much power in the U.S. You need Congress to get a lot of legislation through. So let's quickly talk about the Senate. Who is going to control the Senate? It sounds like, you know, that could change January with these new two seats. But right now, what does it look like in terms of who will control the Senate? And then maybe briefly talk about the House, too.
Right. So the House is pretty clear that the Democrats will retain control of that with a slightly weaker majority than what they had before. Here's the thing about the Senate. I think when people talked about a blue wave scenario in the election, the view was that the Democrats would win, not only win the Senate, but get up to 53 or 54 seats. And on that basis, they would then vote to eliminate the filibuster requirement, which essentially means that you need a 60-vote supermajority to move most legislation through. And obviously gives a lot of power to the minority. That's off the table completely. So what we're back to is sort of what we had with Obama and Mitch McConnell, right, where it's a negotiation between the White House and Republicans in the Senate on everything. Because with the filibuster still being in place, mm-hmm. the Republicans can hold, you know, up Biden's energy secretary or secretary of state or secretary of treasury. They can hold off on cloture votes and all the key legislation. So I think we're looking at a much less ambitious outlook for the Biden climate plan, which obviously has huge implications for our listeners here in Canada. And this is an area where Congress does have a lot of power on domestic energy policy. It will effectively force Biden both to compromise with Republicans in the Senate and to rely more on the regulatory pathway, where as we know, energy and climate policy coming through the regulatory channel tends to be a lot more vulnerable to court challenges. So this is a major shift in the outlook here in our view.
I think what's emerged is this political gridlock situation, which, interestingly, the stock markets find appealing, because it basically means that government will have less power in definitively moving legislation one way or another, whether it's in the tech sector, whether it's in energy, climate, et cetera, right?
Yeah, and I guess the question is really going to be, where is there going to be common ground on energy policy, right? Mm-hmm. So Republicans in the Senate are not against wind and solar tax credits, for example, but what they will do is say, if we're going to support extensions of investment tax and production tax credits for wind and solar, we want relief from some of these proposed changes to oil and gas, right? Or we want more CCS, or we want more biofuels. So it's that kind of horse trading, like we saw with Obama's second term, that I think will be the base case. So I think what you get is a shift from these sort of Green New Deal, clean energy revolution type plans, a little bit more back to the all of the above strategy. And I think a big winner here is natural gas, right? And I think that from a natural gas perspective, Biden's not going to be able to get through his proposed clean energy standard for electric power, which would have been 100% carbon neutral electricity by 2035. That's going to be diluted. And I think that means, you know, natural gas will still be in its current central role in the U.S. power sector. Yes, renewables will continue to grow, but the federal government's thumb will not be on the scale quite the same extent. So yes, you'll get more tax credits for wind and solar, but you're not going to have a restriction on building new gas-fired power plants or mandatory CCS and things like that. So natural gas, I think, comes a winner from this.
Okay, I want to come back to natural gas in a minute and that, because that's such an important point. But I want to get back to your comment about horse trading, which brings us back to the West here and oil and gas in particular. I mean, I think within the first couple of days of Trump getting into power in 16, he issued an executive order to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. And Biden back in May of this year said if he got in, he'd cancel the Keystone XL if he's elected president. So what do you think, given the current situation that's evolving? I mean, does anybody, given all the other issues, COVID-19 and gridlock and all that kind of stuff, is Keystone XL even on anybody's radar right now?
Well, I guess, unfortunately, Alberta, the answer is yes. And I think that the Congress, the Democrat caucus of the Congress, and the sort of Bernie Sanders main party all of our information suggests that they're going to hold Biden to his promise to revoke the Keystone permit very early in his administration. And I think the political dynamics we just discussed, again, unfortunately, in my opinion, reinforce that. Given the constraints Biden will have with the Republican Senate on so many areas of climate policy, Keystone is one area where Biden can act unilaterally and deliver a win, quote-unquote, to one of his most important political constituencies, and the one that most people believe represents the future of the Democrat Party and where the energy is, by this, you know, frankly, somewhat meaningless small gesture of killing Keystone. Meaningless in the sense, not, of course, for Alberta, but meaningless in the sense of U.S. GHG profile and its Paris Agreement commitments. But I think, unfortunately, there's not a lot. From what we're hearing, there is going to be a push from Alberta and Ottawa to sort of offer some, you know, net zero and CCS and whatnot to support Keystone. But I think Biden can't, from what we're hearing, is pretty set that this decision's already been taken.
Yeah, so this project is really a symbol. It's become a symbol for doing something around climate change, even if it really isn't that material or not. And I remember we had met 10 years ago. I think I met you for the first time at a conference, and you were assigning good probabilities to KXL at that point.
It's funny because I've been thinking about the history of this, right? Because I've been covering it since it first came along. And I think back then the view always was, and this is just not our opinion, this is what we heard directly from Obama's White House and his National Security Council and his cabinet, that, you know, the only way they would permit is if there was a carbon tax in Canada, right? Which we now have, but we didn't have at the time under Harper. So these dynamics, it's a moving target, right? One government's priorities, Obama's in one place, Trump was in another, and now Biden's in a different place. The other difference between Biden and Obama is that the blue-collar labor unions that support Keystone, at the leadership level, they're still Democrat, but at the rank and file, a lot of them are now Republican and Trump voters. Look at Ohio. Right. Look at Indiana. Look at a lot of the states in the Midwest, Pennsylvania. You know, those working class white voters, especially males, overwhelmingly support Trump. So that, not that Biden's indifferent to it, especially personally, given his history of Washington, but that they are extremely marginal in the Democrat Party now compared to other interest groups.
Yeah. I want to shift the conversation to geopolitics here in the context of the symbol of KXL. I mean, we know as a consequence of COVID-19 in particular, and the price war between the Saudis and the Americans, which was only, I think it was back in February, which took the price of oil down to unprecedented low levels, that we've seen American oil production fall by 2 million barrels a day. We've seen Canadian oil production fall by anywhere between, I don't know, half and 1 million barrels a day. So all of a sudden, you know, the notion of energy security, energy dominance is weakened. And I guess I'm wondering, does the symbolism of Keystone XL trump the notion of energy security and the fact that, you know, especially heavy oils, where we see Venezuela, we see Mexico and others sort of fall short of their production? Talk about sort of this trade-off between this symbolic Keystone XL and the notion of continental energy security.
So I think Biden in particular understands those dynamics. I mean, the joke about him being in Washington for 47 years, I said that, well, that means he's been there for three energy shocks, right, in 73, 79, and 2008. So he understands full well, more so than Democrats, the importance of oil, the U.S. economy. That said, I think his advisors believe that not approving Keystone XL, given the existence of Line 3 and rails and probably Trans Mountain, the U.S. is not going to be missing any barrels. Right now, we can argue whether that's true, but I think that their view is that they're still going to get the benefits of energy security from Canada, and they're still going to coordinate with the Trudeau government on climate policy, but they can do all that without a Keystone. That's the working hypothesis. I would also say that the energy security is influenced by U.S. going from 13 million to 11 million barrels a day to some degree, but there's also a sense that that's sort of yesterday's issue, right, that the focus now really is the Paris Agreement and competing with China to be the global clean tech leader. If you look at Biden's platform, it's all about we need to rebuild our manufacturing base and do a massive green stimulus and build even better electric vehicles than China. That's the plan, for better or for worse, right? And oil is an afterthought. And I think they are taking for granted the shale industry and the continental supply from Canada and Mexico. Will there be tension with Saudi Arabia? I think that potentially over Iran policy, but probably not over shale, because I don't think Biden will be promoting the shale industry the way that Trump did, negotiating and bullying OPEC Plus for any kind of production strategy that benefits shale producers.
Okay, RJ, let's talk about that. Let's talk about Iran. I think that actually is the most near-term thing that could affect the oil and gas industry here in Canada, is that if the U.S. were to make a deal to get back into the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, so that's the nuclear deal with Iran, there's potential to have sanctions removed on Iranian oil production, and that could add about 2 million barrels a day of extra supply back into the market. Do you think that's likely? When could that occur? And I think you just already answered my third part, which is there going to be any pressure from inside the United States? Because that could be really depressing in terms of what it does to oil price.
Well, after my bleak take on KXL, I'm happy to offer good news on this one. We've dramatically downgraded our expectation of Biden pursuing an Iran deal, given the changes in the Senate and his weaker political mandate overall. I would have said a month ago in the Blue Wave scenario that Biden would look to go back to the JCPOA agreement with the Iranians, which of course Europe and China, Russia are still part of, still exists. U.S. is not in it. But now we think that this is just not going to be the same priority. And while you might get moderate, what we call freeze for freeze, right? Biden might say no new sanctions, and Iran will say no new nuclear activities, and then maybe there'll be a little bit of relief. We actually think the incremental upside for Iran next year is maybe only 200,000 or 300,000 barrels in that scenario. And the worst case scenario of cratering oil market and blowing up the OPEC Plus deal and pushing out spare capacity with that 2 million barrel base swing you mentioned, Jackie, is really remote. Republicans in the Senate will be fiercely against any kind of Iran deal. And it's not that they can block it. What they can do is they can hold a lot of other legislation hostage based on Biden's Iran policy. So we just think Biden's enthusiasm for this and his willingness to do that deal are going to be reduced. So we now see the chances of a comprehensive deal with Iran well below 50%, which is good news for oil prices.
Mm-hmm.
I have one follow-up question. So let's say that OPEC Plus over the next year can't agree to continue to cut their production to the amount they do, even with the good news that maybe they don't have to cut as much if there isn't those Iranian barrels on the market. Do you expect, you know, like President Trump, he surprisingly helped negotiate OPEC Plus to make that big deal. You basically don't think Biden's going to take that on as a role to try to stop the low oil prices from damaging the U.S. economy?
I think anytime anyone asks Biden that question, he's going to talk about renewable energy, and like we need to get away from OPEC and from shale and drive electric vehicles, right? And I think it's interesting, right? We were debating here internally about Pennsylvania, how to interpret the results, right? So if Biden ends up winning Pennsylvania, his home state, along with Delaware, despite pretty public criticism of fracking and saying we need to transition away from oil and gas, what is that? How will the Democrats interpret that? Right. My view personally would be that he probably would have won by more, right, if he hadn't opened up the can of worms on fracking. But others will say, and the Democrats will say, see, this proves that we can win states like Pennsylvania with a clean energy policy. So that's where the focus is, right? They're just not going to bargain with OPEC. It's just going to be saying everything, all the volatility and geopolitical risk of the oil market is why the U.S. needs to take control of its destiny and leverage our manufacturing base and our hardworking people to build electric vehicles.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's an unrealistic argument, frankly. I mean, when we've had the geopolitical issues, you know, throughout Biden's career, the 73 oil price shocks and all the rest of it, since then, we didn't really have viable alternatives to oil-powered mobility. And all of a sudden, for the first time, we do. And so those arguments, in my opinion, are valid. The only thing we would debate is over what time frame they would make a difference.
That's right.
You know, I don't believe the time frame is 5 or 10 years in terms of a huge impact, but positioning today for the future is the dream that the Biden and all his group is selling, and I think that that's going to increasingly dampen the geopolitics of oil.
Yeah, and Biden's people will say that first of all, the U.S. is behind China and Europe on all this stuff, and they need to catch up. And second, they'll say that this isn't the Bernie Sanders plan, which was a 2030 target, right? This is economy-wide net zero by 2050.
Right.
Right, Peter? So in that context, you know, doing cash for clunkers and higher CAFE standards and electric vehicle subsidies now, you're right, it's going to take a couple decades to really roll through. The headline yesterday about the Shell Covent refinery in Louisiana, I mean, did we ever think we'd see a day where a PADD 3 refinery with heavy oil conversion can't find a buyer, right? And that tells you, right, that the big owners of fixed capital, even in the core CAD 3 markets now, are saying at some point,
yep,
if I'm going to buy that refinery, Peter, on your timeline, right, that even if it's 20 years, right, you may have a stranded asset at some point. So
yep.
That's the prevailing thinking in the market right now, which is creating challenges for these companies trying to divest these assets and you know, raising questions.
But in the here and now, we certainly have a strong market for heavy oil. Our Canadian differentials have narrowed substantially. I don't know, typically they're usually $15 and now they're $10. So we're getting some pretty robust prices, although it's hardly robust, you know, when the benchmarks are so low, but you know, it's certainly better than we were. But that's in part due to Venezuela falling off the proverbial map in terms of oil production. Like, where do you see Venezuela going? Because it's always been a major competitor to Canada.
So Biden, I don't think will change U.S. policy towards Venezuela as long as Maduro is still the president of Venezuela. We would see some softening on a humanitarian basis where they might allow more aid and maybe work on a multilateral humanitarian package. But our firm view is that Biden will not change the sanctions policy. Let's say he did, though, and what would happen in Venezuela, right? The reality is, I think there's two challenges. One is that the state of the infrastructure, especially on the conventional oil production of Western Venezuela, is a disaster. And the second challenge is that in this world of energy transition, you know, who are the super majors and national oil companies who would come in and reinvest in Venezuela at this point, right? Russia and China are already there. They're not looking to get more Venezuela exposure. None of the U.S. or European super majors can go back. You know, Repsol maybe, but they're going to net zero. So, you know, it's going to be challenging for Venezuela to find that pathway to have an oil-led recovery, even if Biden did change policy, which we don't think he will. So I think the good news for Canada there is that the heavy oil supply stays tight. Then it really comes back to OPEC Plus. And the other thing that's helping WCS is that, you know, the Saudis and the Iraqis and Kuwaitis and Emiratis have pulled back their heavy oil production as well. That will unwind at some point, but very gradually, right, as demand picks up. So I agree with you. I think in the five-year outlook, WCS is pretty favorable. Given these supply dynamics, I think that the challenge for the Covent refinery in the longer term is people's doubts about, you know, where is the heavy oil demand going to be, say, after 2030? And if I have a long cycle investment upstream or downstream, it's not that much risk between now and 2030. It's the after 2030 risk that's causing hesitation.
But we do have a fair amount of spare capacity for processing heavy crudes in the Gulf Coast. I think I looked and the consumption of, or the imports of heavy oil in the U.S. are down almost 1.5 million barrels a day from their peak. So even if some refineries shut down, there's still a significant amount of capacity there.
Right. But I guess the question there is how much of that is because of COVID and because of OPEC Plus, right? That spare capacity, and under normal circumstances, you know, you'll see those run rates go back up. But I agree with you. Again, it's not an issue for this year, but to me, it's very telling there's no buyer for that project. I would have thought, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, you would see a Canadian buyer for a project like that who would want more downstream integration with Gulf Coast.
To integrate, yeah.
Let's switch to the climate issue. And we've talked a bit about Biden's climate plan and how without control of the Senate, it may be harder to implement that. But one thing that he has talked about is that he wants to get back into the Paris Accord and not only just sign up for it again, but convince others to take on more stringent targets. First of all, without the control of the Congress, is he going to be able to do that? And how is that going to work out? Like, is he going to convince other countries, including China, that they need to even get more aggressive when the U.S. has really, you know, relaxed some of their goals and ambitions?
It's been a long week, and I'm a bit sleep deprived. I'm going to say this anyway. I think, honestly, this is a disaster for the Paris Agreement, right? I just think that Biden is going to make bold commitments that the Republicans in the Senate simply won't follow through on, right? That, yes, incrementally, there will be support for wind and solar electric vehicles, but you're not going to have the massive $2 trillion green stimulus. You're not going to, you know, even the ban on drilling in federal lands is going to, the Republicans are going to lobby against that. So what you're going to have is more of the same, right, which is an all-of-the-above energy strategy. Republicans consist on natural gas, nuclear oil, remaining part of the fuel mix, and strong regional variation where states like California and New York are moving towards net zero, and other states are simply content with the status quo, right, which is in most cases a fossil fuel dominated fuel mix with very low cost prices. So I don't see why China or Europe would be impressed by any commitment that Biden makes that they know he can't follow through on. So the question of even the Obama nationally determined contribution, you know, that there's 30% cuts by 2030, there's a lot of heavy lifting just to get to that. And electric vehicles and wind and solar are part of the road. But we start talking about economy-wide net zero by 2050. That was the big centerpiece of that plan, was 100% carbon-free electricity by 2035 under Biden, and I think that's off the table.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the Paris Agreement is 5 years old, and it seems like we've moved on to much more stringent targets. I mean, net zero by 2050 is more stringent than the Paris Agreement ever was. And I want to pick up on your comment about California and New York and other states going to net zero by 2050, states going to the low carbon fuel standard. Those are things that are independent, really, of the presidency, right? I mean, the states are actually acting, you know, significant states are acting more aggressively than the Paris Agreement. And that ultimately has impact on Canada, doesn't it?
Yes and no, right? The problem is it's not all states, right? I kind of like to show clients the map of the U.S. according to regional transmission organizations, right? And what you see is that you have, you know, states in California, New England, New York, parts of the Midwest that have created, you know, these clean energy markets that are moving towards decarbonization. But then you have these big white patches on the map in the Rockies, in the Southeast, where basically states still set their own electricity policy independent of Washington. So I think that's the dichotomy going forward. So the states that are going green will continue to do so, and the states that are prefer all of the above and want to maintain control of their own electricity policy and climate policy will continue that. Whereas the way around that would have been, if you had the blue wave and the Democrats won the Senate, they would have revised the Federal Power Act and expanded federal authority over a lot of those states that don't have RTOs or ISOs.
I see.
And that's where the Republicans are going to push back against that, right? They're just going to say, no, we're quite happy to have state regulation in some of our states, and we don't want Washington to take control of us, especially with a Democrat president. So if you can't change the Federal Power Act, then and if your FERC nominees are still being held up by Republicans in Senate, then we're back to same old, which is, again, some states in the U.S. will be global leaders in clean electricity and decarbonization and hydrogen, frankly. Mm-hmm. Others will look a lot like they did 20 years ago.
But talk about the ones that are really consequential to Western Canadian oil and gas, which is like the Midwestern states like Illinois, where the big refineries are, you know, places like that. What's the assessment in terms of things like low carbon fuel standard trickling up the pipe all the way to here from the implementation there?
So this is the big piece that I held off writing because I wanted to see what happened left and right. But I think there's an interesting story about the Canadian Clean Fuel Standard and the Biden plan, right, for ethanol. So the Renewable Fuel Standard expires in the U.S. in 2022. And there's talk that Biden will replace it with a low carbon fuel standard, right? The California policy being taken nationally. So on the one hand, that sounds negative, right? Because it sounds like you could have, you know, the GHG intensity reductions on an annual basis that could be a challenge for heavy oil in Canada. On the other hand, it actually might level the playing field, right? That if Canada did a standalone clean fuel standard that wasn't aligned with the U.S. under Trump, that would be one thing. If it's aligned with North America and you create a robust offset market and clean energy credit market, that there could be ways to reform Canada's clean fuel standard to make it more favorable, especially for companies that are already committed to going to net zero, like some of the oil sands players are. So I'll be interested to see how much Biden can do on a federal low carbon fuel standard. Republicans will not necessarily be against that because they're going to support biofuels and they're going to support blue hydrogen, right? So the horse trading around that is going to be really interesting as we get to the expiration of the RFS in 2022.
Fascinating.
So if I were Trudeau, I would hold off on clean fuel standard, wait and see what happens in the U.S.
Well, I do think the clean fuel standard is moving forward here in Canada, and we are going to have some future podcasts to explain it. But there are some real advantages to it because it will create credits, fairly high-priced credits for reducing your emissions, and maybe upstream oil and gas companies can actually get paid to do blue hydrogen and CCS and things like that.
No, I agree with that. I think that if the Canadian companies are going net zero, which many of them are, then I think the right kind of clean fuel standard or LCFS can support that through the offset markets and through creating value for blue, things like blue hydrogen and, you know, other clean liquids. So we'll come back to that another day, but that's one thing for sure.
Well, we will come back to it another day, but I don't want to let you go here in our limited time before asking you to explain the situation in Georgia. There's a couple Senate seats that are going to be coming up here in January, I think, and that could tip the balance. What's your assessment of that? What's going on there?
Right. So the two races too close to call could be likely be runoff. It's amazing to runoff of two Senate races in one state. We would give the Republicans a slight edge in holding those seats just because voter turnout tends to be lower than special elections. And I think that in a Biden victory, Republican voters in Georgia will probably really turn out. But it's going to be a massive, injection of national money into those two races. Democrats will do what they can to win. Republicans will do what they can to win. But we give a slight incumbency advantage to Republicans, which supports that scenario of them getting the 51 seats.
But that still won't get the filibuster situation solved, right? So it's not really game-changing the way it would have been if you got more Senate seats.
Exactly. That's the big difference.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's the key factor that I see.
All right. Well, you know, there's so much we could keep talking about, but I think we've run out of time, unfortunately. It's been great to get your insights, RJ, and we really appreciate you sharing your thoughts on the U.S. election and energy policy. I know that's the big questions being asked here in Canada this week, and you've addressed really all of them.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, RJ. And I don't think our audience may know that you are actually a Canadian living in the United States. So we look forward to seeing you back home at some point and seeing you in Calgary.
I look forward to that as well.
We'll put a link to your website. So if folks want to look you up, they'll have your information right there. Really appreciate you joining. And thanks to our audience for joining the podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.